That's just a good recording, doing? Man.
Yeah,
I can
brother,
dig
like,
it.
Stop. Right on.
Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Good morning to you, Connor. How you doing?
Doing all right, Earl.
It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, we've got, and I say this all the time, I knew Connor was a bright guy. But yesterday, he took on a guy who has written a book about global warming. And scientifically, this guy who was, you know, had all kind of credentials, our Connor handled him, put him inside of a box that he couldn't get out of. Man, I mean, Connor is a brilliant, brilliant.
It's not very difficult when he's peddling the lie that global warming is completely fallacious.
turn your microphone up a little bit.
I said it's not very difficult when he was peddling the lie that global warming is completely fallacious. So, I mean...
You mean there is global warming?
Well, the guy was denying it.
He basically denied the idea that fossil fuels have any effect on to climate change or global warming whatsoever. And his entire theory was that it was a conspiracy because of the carbon trading market. Because the idea is to make it so you can implement a more rigorous carbon tax. So then companies that profit from that market can make more money by peddling the idea that global warming is terrible and we have to limit our CO2 emissions. That's completely wrong to me. Because the notion that global warming is a true thing. I literally pulled up. he referenced a study from the University of Atlanta or Alabama, I think, in Huntsville, talking about the general temperature in the tropospheric level over the past 20 or 30 years, right? And he referenced this study, and he was like, okay, well, this study says that the temperature's only gone up 0.013 Celsius. And I go to 2016, and it says 0.4, which is significantly higher than 0.01. And I pull it up for Earl. He's like, that's not true. That's not what it says. And I'm looking at it on the screen, and I'm just like, okay, well... What am I supposed to do?
And I hurried up and cut Connor off. At least I don't have a job anymore. he took the guy apart with scientific information, young Connor.
Well, anyone who talks about the troposphere has got me by a little bit in terms of global warming.
And Sandy, he was brilliant. So I just let him go ahead, and my guess was from, I forgot where he was. He was a high-ranking scientific mind, and at every turn, young Connor checkmated him. And, man, yes, you'd have been very proud of him, man. He's 20 years old, man, you know. And he's got a very bright future ahead of him. How did you get so, you know, inclined, man, to deal with the climate and those kind of things?
I mean, it's just a lot of research on it, honestly. Like, articles I've read, YouTube essays and things I've watched. Like, and then, you know, taking notes on those things, memorizing certain points, and then just thinking about it from, like, a logical point of view. I wouldn't say that I'm like an expert or anything, because there are people definitely a lot more intelligent than me on climate.
But I think people should
have a general knowledge of things. I think that's the biggest problem with our current democracy right now. People have different facts. They use certain talking points peddled by certain people to express certain points. They don't really think about it from like a deductive point of view.
Well, and they they don't have facts. We can't seem to get an agreed upon set of facts.
Yeah.
And facts are something that usually are indisputable, right? Once you get to the point of having a fact, then now you can't argue about it anymore. Now you have to figure out what what that fact means in the general scheme of things. So I think you're absolutely right. Well, the biggest problem we've got in our democracy is we migrate away from facts to talking points, and talking points that talk about facts that aren't confirmed or even valid.
Well, this guy kept talking absolutely that climate change is not real, and he was.
Well, I don't think any scientist doesn't say there isn't climate change. The question has always been the extent to which humans have contributed to the extent.
He said zero.
Yeah, well, that's obviously, you know, and the scientific evidence is clear that based on the change and the rate of change, and based on correlations between that change and the rate of change and various kinds of human conduct, there's all kinds of scientific and mathematical correlative studies that show that it's correlated. You know, there's definitely a correlation.
So anyway, Connor Jess really took the guy apart. Took him to the woodshed, yeah. and I'm like, wow! I knew Connor had some things going for himself. I didn't know.
So I've got to be careful. I got to be more careful now.
I didn't know he was the next Sandy Williams. You know,
no, Sandy, you're great. Like, there's a lot of things you memorize, and I'm like, how does he even know that off the top of his head?
Yeah, no. Well, anyway, let's bring Tom from LA on. He was. You know, listening to how masterful young Connor was yesterday. Hey, Tom, what's going on?
That's me clapping for Connor.
Thank you, Tom.
First off, great job, Connor. I'm going to get to my other point in 1 second, so please give me time. Number one, that guy was a huckster. That guy was a grifter. That guy was a mini Trump. You always have to question when someone speaks in absolutes. And Earl, I was even pushing back with you on the radio a little bit, saying let Connor speak, because this guy was basically just trying to run over Connor with a bunch of different terms, which is what these people do, that nobody can look them up in time. Because of the fact that he just keeps on talking and fraudster, fraudster, fraudster. And my book. I mean, he was looking to sell books, of course. So the thing is, which I have no problem with, but the thing is, first of all, Connor killed him. He was talking about water droplets, not even carbon. This guy was such a crazy person. He sold two books yesterday, I bet, one to CJ and one to Dave. You know, and that really was about it. I think the rest of the listening audience was looking at this guy going, okay, but that's what they do. See, science is always changing. Science is not a definitive, and that's part of the problem with science. But these hucksters come on, and they make it like it's a definitive and like it's the only way. And then all people want to be led by those more competent than they are. So then all these little sheep just follow these people right off the cliff. And that's exactly what happened with Donald Trump and everything else that happens with any of these autocratic leaders. I would like to say one thing, though, that we, the people, are the government, and we need to realize that. I don't know if our media every day would get on and say, we, the people, are the government. This is about us. Maybe then we would not be spending so much money on the military-industrial complex. Maybe then we would actually spend the money back on the taxpayers to actually get the return on investment from the actual money that's going to we the people government. Ronald Reagan got his dream, which was basically to make government where it doesn't work. And he's made it so people don't trust anything, whether it's government, whether it's corporations, whoever it is. No one trusts anybody anymore. And the reason for that is because of the fact that we've had so much distrust in money and politics, et cetera, you know, in our system. It's just so corrupt. But I have a question for Sandy. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go on my tirade, but again, Connor, you are a rock star and you kicked that guy's ass. And second off, Sandy, what do you think of the idea of having on our pay stubs or on our receipts something where it actually itemizes where each of the tax dollars are actually going that we pay, since we the people are the government, ultimately, What do you think of that idea? So if you got a receipt and it said, okay, this much is going towards this, this much is going towards this, out of your paycheck, this is how much is going, you know, towards social services, this is how much is going towards the military industrial complex, whatever it might be, but an actual itemized receipt so people can see where their tax dollars are actually going so they can feel good about paying the taxes.
All right, Tom, thank you very much for the call.
Well, I think it's definitely a good idea that people would begin to understand where their tax dollars go. I'm not exactly for the government mandating that private receipts created by the pay stubs include that, but certainly a 1099 and the things that you get from the government that relate to your taxes and taxes paid should show that. It could also be on the forms that are sent out with the taxes to pay your taxes, so you understand at the time of payment where your tax money is going. That might be the most kind of poignant kind of way to let people understand where their money is going at the time that they're filling out their tax returns. I'm all for it because there's so much myth and so much illogical thinking that's going on about and assumptions that are made. For instance, that somehow welfare is a huge portion of payments, that welfare is what's causing our taxes to go up when you can look at the actual dollars and the relative dollars spent in the budget and understand that that's just not the case at all.
Thank you very much for the call, Tom. You know, Sandy, we're about to go to a break in a few minutes, but I want to talk about the changing landscape of the Democratic primary for United States Senator. And, you know, Mark Lazary put almost $15 million into a race of his own money. And there's a lot of conjecture, there's a lot of angst and anger by people who supported him, who are saying all sorts of crazy things about why he got out. But a man that puts $15 million into a race is got to be a pretty bright guy in the first place to even get in this.
Let's put it this way. He and his family have been good investors, and they understand where to put good money, and they understand the principle of not putting good money after bad. And so, you know, my guess is that this was based
on... Sandy, hold the thought. We got to go to break. 844-967-2789. We'll be back. You know, to the Earl Ingram Show, as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, as I was listening to Michael McDonald just now, and I looked over at you and I opened my eyes, and I thought it was Michael McDonald. You got the same beard and all. You don't.
Ooh. now I've got to go look at Michael McDonald.
You know who Michael McDonald is. This guy that's just singing there in the background, man.
Oh,
he made some great, great songs. But anyway.
A rock star.
Yeah, no question. What's he look like?
Oh, I'll go with that.
But anyway. So how does a man as bright as Mark Lazary, who realizes that there's, and he said that he had three choices, that he could either continue to stay in the race and come in second, or, you know, he could either end this thing right now, or he could go negative in the last couple of weeks, or he could end it right now. He chose the latter, which shows character, right? I mean,
well, yeah, sensibility and character, sure. Just because he'd already put money in, it's sort of like someone who's invested a bunch of money in a business, and the business is obviously going south, not going to make it. unsavable? Should he throw more money into it, or should he pull the plug? And I think that's, you know, Mark made the decision. I'm going to pull the plug.
Yeah, they just saw that things weren't getting better. His numbers weren't going up. He was still spending his money, and so clearly Mandela Barnes, Lieutenant Governor, is going to be the nominee. Do you think there's any way he can defeat Ron Johnson, in your opinion?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I don't think it's a – I think any senatorial race in Wisconsin is going to be a close one because of the nature of the political makeup of the state, the geopolitics of it. But, yeah, I think he's got a very good opportunity. And I think he's going to get a lot of national support. I mean, the fact that Elizabeth Warren comes in and campaigns for him. So he's going to have the progressive wing, which extends far beyond the inner city community. In fact, it might be a different wing of the party than the African American portion. So yeah, I think he's got a serious opportunity.
Yeah, 35 years old. Here's a guy who could become a United States senator. I don't know. That's got to be one of the youngest United States senators in the history if he's able to pull this off, right? I mean, right. 35 years old?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the minimum age to be a U.S. senator is pretty close to that. So
yeah. And
there aren't many who've been younger, and if they've been younger, they haven't been much younger.
No. And so, you know, you could say a guy like that could be there for 40 years. You know, once a person becomes an incumbent senator, it's almost impossible to defeat them unless they do what Ron Johnson has done, right?
Yes.
I mean, he's alienated even people on the right.
I mean, unless you put a red ball on your nose, wear shoes that are size 18.
You know, the more, and the Democrats see this as an opening, right? I mean, clearly, they see this as an opening, a seat that they probably never would have thought they could have won. And so nationally, they're going to invest whatever it takes financially in that seat.
Well, and hopefully the people of Wisconsin will also be all in terms of evaluating the circumstance and deciding on who should be their U.S. senator.
Well, here's the other part of it, and what most people may not know. Is the one thing that I do know about Lieutenant Governor Barnes, he's traveled the state over and over and over. And as Lieutenant Governor, that's what he was doing. All over the state, repeatedly, people know him from all across the state. They know him to be a fair-minded guy. But can you imagine two Democratic senators in the state of Wisconsin? Has that ever happened?
Oh, yeah, for a long time, actually.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
But it's been a long time since it was.
We had Gaylord Nelson and William Proxmire, and they were side-by-side senators for 50s and 60s.
Right.
And so, yeah, we had a fair time for that.
Yeah, 50s and 60s. Help me do the math.
Okay, that's quite a while ago.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that will... So, Sandy...
Well, I think it was until Bob Caston became a U.S. senator. I don't think we'd had a Republican up until that point for quite a while.
Wow. So if that does happen, it certainly catapults the state of Wisconsin into a much broader position and conversation nationally, wouldn't you say?
Well, I guess so. Although, you know, that's the interesting thing about the situation that's created in state houses as the result of the concentration of Democratic votes in urban areas. And that is that we'll continue to have a state house that will be strongly biased in the direction of conservative Republicanism, and we'd have a Democratic governor and two Democratic senators,
which really is an amazing thing. And yet, even with all that power, two Democratic senators, a Democratic governor, there will still be the state house will still be kind of in flux.
Well, I'm not in flux. I think the state house is pretty clearly, unless there would be some, you know, large transition in that social,
which can happen.
Well, it could happen. And as I have advocated, if the Democratic Party learns how to outreach to the more rural Americans who are really coincident in interest to much of what the Democratic Party is interested in accomplishing, if they learn how to message that, if they learn how to change the way they model themselves in terms of what they're pursuing, I think it's very possible that this whole rural red thing could get changed.
Yeah, but it's not going to happen in this time around.
No, it's not going to happen
this time around.
It's not going to happen in one cycle, but it definitely could happen over a period of 5 or 10 years.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday. About to say Tuesday. First, I was going to say Monday. With Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
The imprimatur of it not being a partisan political witch hunt.
So Sandy, he clearly, if he would just shut up and go away,
yes,
they would end this, yes, going after him. But he's so stubborn that he was on. I was watching him the other day, and he was telling his followers, "They don't want me to represent you anymore."
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know?
he's got.
He's masterful, right?
He is masterful, and he's masterful at playing the instrument, which is his group, this group that is strongly in his corner, and he's created them, and they're a bunch of disaffected people who are upset with things, and are willing and interested in having a strong man leader rather than a democracy. They hate government so much, most of them, that they want to essentially upend the government as it exists and install someone who they think they trust. And little do they know that history has shown that when the people install a dictator, they made a mistake. And they made a mistake that's personal to themselves, because, you know, dictators are all about their own power, and they aren't about power to the people.
You know, he really is a dictator.
Well, that's what he wants to be.
Yeah. I don't think... And I know in my lifetime, I've never seen a man like him to ever ascend to the presidency. He may have been historically, but I've never seen one.
Well, I mean, we've had populists who were good at whipping up people through dog whistles. George Wallace.
Yeah, he wasn't the president.
But he did. He did get a surprising number of votes,
right,
when he ran for the presidency. I'm just saying that there have been people who've tried this game, and they haven't succeeded. I think Trump is the first one who's tried this game at the national level and has clearly succeeded.
Suddenly, he's going to force their hand. I mean, he is. The more he does this, and the more he keeps pushing this, he's going to force the hand of Merrick Garland and others to actually go after him.
I think what he's going to force the hand of is the decent Republicans who are finally going to surface and decide that he's going to destroy the Republican Party. I think you can look forward in time and look at the Republican convention in Milwaukee and foresee a convention in which Trump runs for the presidency. So does, let's say, DeSantis.
Right.
And based on the Republican Party beginning to wake up, you can see that the possibility that DeSantis gets the nomination and Trump doesn't. What does Trump do then? Well, Trump is not going to, he didn't accept the loss of the presidency, and he's not going to accept the loss of the nomination for the vice presidency, and he will run off and destroy the Republican Party with his next move. And so I think the Republicans can look forward to that. And they can see that Donald Trump poses a significant threat to the Republican Party, because if they don't hand him the nomination, he's going to tear them apart. And so I think there are Republicans who are beginning to wake up and say, you know, maybe we're better off with Donald Trump locked up, or at least locked out of the political process. Liz Cheney's idea of passing the necessary legislation to ban him from running for political office is probably the most benign way that they could accomplish this.
You know, Sandy, you see more and more of what you just said happening. They are starting to fall off of.
Yeah. I mean, you got Mike, you have Mike Pence, you have Ron DeSantis, you have a growing number of Republicans, you have the decent part of the, you have Liz Cheney talking about running for the presidency. You know, Adam Kinzinger, we'll see what he's going to do, but I suspect he's not going to give up the fact that he's in the national limelight. There's going to be, and Mitt Romney, there are these people who already are disaffected. You've got this group of Republicans and Democrats who yesterday announced that they were going to start the Forward Party. And they were going to seek out and get moderates from both parties. There's a whole bunch of things lining up that are going to cause the Republican Party to reconsider the path that they're currently on, and particularly reconsider the Donald Trump path.
Well, Donald Trump has clearly put together a lot of donors and people who are still giving money. He's raised over $100 million already. And you know, he wouldn't put it past him to figure out a way to put the money in his pocket.
Well, you know, well, he's already. it's clear that he's that's clearly a possibility and a probability, and it's pretty clear that it indirectly, it has found its some of it has found its way into his pocket already. I do think that the people who are large donors are beginning to falter in terms of their willingness to give money to Trump. And I think a lot of this money that he's getting now is stuff that he's sort of fraudulently obtained through his whole the stolen election lie that he has used to raise lots of money over the internet and other ways in smaller donations from people who can ill afford to give their money away but are persuaded that they're doing the patriotic thing.
You know, Sandy, you use the term fraud. It's in the open. Everybody sees it and they know it, but they're all still, you're just saying they don't want to go down that road.
Well, he calls it, this election that he says was stolen from him, and the theory that he, this subliminal theory that he presents to the people, because he presents no overt theory. He simply gives them the opportunity to fabricate their own theory. And I think the largest, most consistent fabricated theory that people come up with who like to embrace his notion is that too many people voted in this election who they wish wouldn't vote. Okay, and so they would like to wish away. They don't think they deny that the votes occurred. They just wish those people wouldn't vote. And by those people, I'm talking about
people of color,
right. And people without a lot of money, people liberals.
Right.
People who vote for the liberal side are those people, and they wish that not so many of those people would vote. And so that's what Donald Trump is selling, is the fact that the election was stolen from him because the other side devised a bunch of ways to make it much easier for those people to vote.
So many of the Republicans supported that theory, but it's almost 2 years later now.
Well, Republicans support that theory because, you know what? When those people vote, you know, when it's made easier for lots of people to vote, when lots of people vote,
their views,
Republicans don't win.
Right.
The Republicans are premised on having small, in fact, people talk about it. Republicans talk about it. In small turnout elections, Republicans do very well because a higher percentage of Republicans vote than the percentage of those people.
Yeah.
Okay? And so when lots of people vote, meaning that those people turn out as well, well, then Republicans lose. So Republicans say, well, look, the Republicans have been very overt about what they're trying to do. They are trying to make it harder for those people to vote. They want to get voter ID stuff. They want to make it complicated to vote, okay? They aren't saying that you shouldn't vote because you aren't a proper person to vote. Their strategy is all about just making it more complicated so that people who are not willing to jump through all the necessary hoops won't vote.
So Sandy, you don't see Donald Trump backing out of this?
No,
he's not going to back out. So and the heat is being turned up on him, whether he likes it or not. He knows that it's kind of like they're cornering him.
Well, except that one of his strategies is that one of his best defenses against getting prosecuted is being an actual participant in the political process, because then it looks more like a witch hunt. So there's lots of people, credible experts, who believe that one of the reasons he will announce for the presidency and
soon.
And do it much earlier than would be the norm, is because he wants to be an active candidate so that these criminal processes begin to look and smell more like political witch hunts.
But Sandy, I listened to Merrick Garland, and he explained why he's taking the time. He knows how critically important this is. Do you think let's say Trump does announce soon, you think that Merrick Garland is going to all of a sudden say, oh, wait a minute, he's running?
No, I don't think Merrick Garland will, but I think that the pitch of Trump's arguments that it's a political witch hunt will reach a crescendo, and I think his constituents, the ones who are, you know, really like crazily locked into his camp, will protest, will do all the things that people worry about, like Merrick Garland worry about in terms of tearing up society by pursuit of the legal remedies.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday. It means Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. So, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. It means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, I was thinking the other day, I looked at some pictures that I took and some videos that I shot when I was at the last time Donald Trump was here. And I was at his rally. I never told you that. I was, I was at that rally, and man,
I thought it might be an SOS.
And the energy that was there, Sandy, was just unparalleled, unmatched. Whatever it is he had on people, he really, truly. I remember him when he said he could shoot somebody on
Fifth Avenue.
He knew even early on that he had this magnetism with certain people. And man, there's And these people were willing to do whatever it was.
Interestingly, at the same time that he was saying that, he would talk privately and in a very derogatory fashion about these people that followed him. In fact, yeah. that statement was, if you kind of parse it out, a pretty derogatory statement. He was saying, I've got these fools
right.
who will follow me around. It wouldn't matter what I do because they'll do anything to, you know. And he kind of understood that he was tapping into people. And he was tapping into feelings that people had that were very strongly held, but he was tapping into a bunch of people that he was always very very derogatory about. He had nothing in common with them other than the ability, much like an entertainer, to somehow figure out what it is they needed to hear.
So the Republican Party watched the manifestation of this Frankenstein monster, right? They all rode Fox News, all of them.
Well, like I think you said off the air, I think it was even better. They didn't watch it. They created it.
Yeah.
You know, they saw it. They salivated over his ability to change the party. I mean, let's face it. The people that he attracted were not the traditional Republicans,
right?
You know, they were like, but different than the Tea Party Republicans. Many of these people were the people we've talked about on other occasions, the people who voted blue from Wisconsin Rapids and from outstate Wisconsin. Now, if you go to those places, it's all Trump signs.
You know, Sam,
he figured out how to tap into that.
I remember I was in D.C. at Tea Party rally, and I went through and walked through the Tea Party rally, and I remember having some conversations with the people in the Tea Party. They were different than the Trump people.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just there clearly was a difference.
Well, they actually had an issue that they were addressing. I mean, they were all upset about taxes,
right.
Yes. And so they actually had a fundamental governmental issue. Trump has tapped into what is essentially the anarchist impulse, which is the people who have become so angry with government and so angry with their circumstance that they want to get rid of government as it is now, and they want to replace it with someone that is sympathetic to them, i.e. Donald Trump. It's why this poll that showed that 40% of the group polled favored an autocrat over a democratically elected person, that they wanted to have ruled by a strong person rather than every 4 years having someone face election.
You know, he put a stamp on the Republican Party, as you were talking about, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Boebert, Getz, all of these people who would have never...
Josh Cawley?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of people who have been elected to office who would never have been favored with getting elected because of the way they conducted themselves, the way they talked, the things that they said, the things they did. And yet Donald Trump made all those things not only legitimate, but attractive in terms of demonstrating that someone was so disaffected from the establishment that what they were going to do was they were going to tear down the government as it is and create it in a way that in many ways wouldn't even be suggestive of what the founding fathers were after. And what's interesting is most of the people who felt that strongly would be all about protecting the Constitution, when all of their conduct was about destroying the constitutional values of the founding fathers.
You know, Sandy, that's the part of it that I don't understand when the Republicans and even the average everyday Republican talks about how much they love the Constitution, they love the nation, and all of those things. And yet they don't see what they're doing as the exact opposite. It's almost like they're brainwashed into all the things that they fight for and want to go to battle for.
It even goes up to those with high intellectual content in terms of what they're talking about. Justice Alito, a couple of days ago, gave a speech. The content of the speech was revealed a couple of days ago. I think he gave the speech some while ago at Notre Dame. But in that speech, he was talking, and I heard an excerpt from it on the radio this morning. He was talking about how religious freedom was dwindling in the United States, and I was surprised by that, because I've never understood that there was any attack on the capacity of people to worship as they chose in their places of worship or in their homes. And that's the kind of religious freedom that the pilgrims were looking for when they came to the United States. They just didn't want a government to try and impose any religion on them. They didn't want their kids to go to a school, a public school, that had religion presented to them in a manner that was different than the religion that they themselves worshipped. Because back then, if the religion that was going to be presented to them would have been Catholicism, and they were all Protestants wanting to do something else.
Now
Alito is, when someone like Alito talks about religious freedom, he's talking about the ability of public schools to essentially impose Christian views in the public school on students.
Well, they're talking about Christian nationalism.
Yes.
And so how can you talk about the founding fathers and what all these things stood for?
Yeah.
And that was not allowed or wasn't in the purview of the founding fathers. They knew that could do nothing but separate our nation.
Well, you know, they strongly feared what they were leaving, which was essentially Catholic nationalism.
Right.
But you can substitute Christian nationalism for Catholic, because if you're Jewish or Muslim or Buddhist or Hindu or some other religion, then Christian nationalism sounds just as forbidding to you as Catholic nationalism sounded in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s. So, you know, our founding fathers were running away from, and they didn't want the Establishment Clause was all about making sure that there was no combination of church and state.
You know, Sandy, there are people who push back against that and say there was never a separation of church and state. That wasn't there. And I've heard people try to debate that. Were they correct in that?
Well, the way they debate it is they point at things that say one nation under God, for instance. They'll look at writings by the founding fathers that make a reference to God, and they'll say that, see? See what I mean? But that was really more about vernacular at the time and how people talked and thought. And also understand that our founding fathers, while Judaism existed, the fact that there were Muslims or Hindus was pretty hidden from people at that point in time. And there certainly weren't many, if any of them, in the United States at that time. So that the thought process was restricted by people's experience. But it wasn't, the concept of separating church from state was clearly in their mind.
And you can see now that their forethought about it was correct. Because all of what's happening right now is clearly Christendom wants to make it clear that Christianity is the religion of our nation.
Well, yes. And, you know, the notion of setting the standards for morality and ethics in this country based on religious standards, I guess, is sort of reflected by the Roe v. Wade concept and the movement that reacted against the existence of choice, of woman's choice. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear that ever since Rex Reed and the Christian right became such a strong lobbying influence in Washington, and ever since they became such a strong impulse in politics. And it's clear that Donald Trump, one of the groups that he tapped into, pandered to, was the Christian right. He made all kinds of promises to them, which if you can credit someone for keeping their promises, Donald Trump did keep his promises. His appointments to the Supreme Court were as he promised. But, you know, it's all a dangerous impulse.
Yeah. You know, Sandy, it really is, because in the long run, it's unsustainable to continue to push one religion in a nation that is made up of all the different religions.
Yes.
And that people are going to be silent on that.
Well, in fact, one of the concepts behind American exceptionalism was this melting pot concept that we were the place that people would move to from all over the world, and instead of being separated by their ethnicities and their religions and their color, they would all be combined and unified under the principle of being Americans and the principle of American government. And here we are tearing apart the very core of that principle, which is welcoming immigrants, being a melting pot, accepting everyone.